decades incarcerated there. The deal for alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two others who confessed to being behind the World Trade Center attack plot following extensive enhanced interrogation had their hopes of release quashed in the 11th hour by the American Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. Austin's interference has elicited reaction from both civil liberties organizations and constitutional scholars in the United States. Andy Worthington is an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band. His book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and the Battle of the Beanfield. Andy's articles appear at his website, andyworthington.co.uk, where I found his latest. Lloyd Austin cynically revokes 9/11 plea deals, which correctly concluded that the use of torture is incompatible with the pursuit of justice. Welcome back to the program, Andy.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, now I see that was your latest. I know how prolific you are. I know you're working on something else, covering what happened today while you were down in the streets of London. Andy, and the situation here can't really be overstated, that it's very dangerous to be on the streets right now, and especially if you're in the company of people that are less lily white, say, than you and I. Andy, you and your fellows in support of justice for the inmates of Guantanamo were out there in the streets of London. How was your reception on the street today, Andy?
Well, I have to say, Chris, that the safest places in the UK, I would say, are large cities. You know, it's noticeable that in some of the far right agitation that's happened, they've been resisted by superior numbers of anti-fascists. I'm thinking in particular of Bristol, which is the largest city in the West Country, which, you know, has a long and proud history of resisting fascism. London as a whole is immune to the scourge of far-right vandalism and Islamophobia and violence, with one exception, that a particular agitator called Tommy Robinson — that's not his real name — he organized a protest in Whitehall, so the seat of government, just after the attacks in Southport, you know, which were completely wrongly blamed on either Muslims or immigrants, and that's the only violence that we've seen in London. And Tommy Robinson is—he's not even in the country. He's sunning it up in Cyprus, I think, in a holiday resort, via whatever type of funding he has. There are certainly suspicions that that various Israelis or organizations connected to the State of Israel fund him. He's got a long history as a provocateur and is something of a kind of pin-up amongst the British far right. But that's the only incident that there's been. And, you know, I feel that London is a safe and tolerant place. As I must say, I think in general, the country is a safe and tolerant place. The far right people represent a minority of the British people. And, you know, they've definitely been inspired by the most revolting anti-immigration policies of the recent Tory government, who also don't represent the decency fundamentally of the majority of the British people.
Well, there's a line of thinking, especially that I'm following on Twitter, that's saying, well, that this foment, this unrest, and especially when you mentioned Tommy Robinson, who's got strong links to the through the English Defense League, to the Jewish Defense League, and to Israel as well. He's received tens of thousands of pounds over the long years that he's been there. Maybe he's getting ready to deploy from Cyprus. I know that there's British bases there to join the war that seems to be ready to break out any day. But is there any credence, do you think, Andy, to the theory that this unrest has been unleashed by Israeli intelligence to punish Britain for its waning support of Israel and its some comments it made about the ICC, the International Criminal Court, case against it?
Well, I wouldn't suggest that, Chris. I don't think that we've seen much in the way of pushback against Israel from the new Labour government. You know, I mean, as we know, Keir Starmer, you know, was so so dedicated in his support for Israel that as a human rights lawyer, he suggested just after the October 7th attacks that Israel had the right to cut off food, water and fuel to the Gaza Strip, which is demonstrably a war crime, and he should have known better. We've yet to see much in the way of a pushback. You know, David Lammy, our foreign secretary, his first foreign trip was to Israel after the government was elected. We're hearing rumors of a possible ban on arms sales, and we're also hearing that the British may not obstruct, as the Tories had planned, the ICC request for the arrest of Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant. But that's not much. I would say that if there is an Israeli angle to this, it's that they're pushing violence against against Muslims and false stories about Muslims and their barbarism, etc., as part of their mission to if you like, try and whitewash their genocide. That if they can start a much wider pushback against Muslims, then it helps to hide the naked horror of what they're still doing in the Gaza Strip.
Well, and that naked horror, again, in your article, Lloyd Austin cynically revokes 9/11 plea deals, which correctly conclude that the use of torture is incompatible with the pursuit of justice, as well as Guantanamo, that you include some of the pictures coming out of Israel of the Sde Tamim prison. Notably, but there's things going on there that resemble what people may remember coming out of Bagram Air Force Base prison and Abu Ghraib prison when the Americans were occupying Iraq. Emaciated, shackled prisoners that clearly have been ill-used. What do you think about this tie-in now? We seem to be coming to a closed loop here where everything over these last 25 years or so seems to be coming around to complete itself. We're now being presented, it seems to me, with the picture of the future that George W. Bush promised with his generational war in 2001.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, Chris. I mean, I have to say, I do think that Guantanamo remains a legacy problem rather than anything else for the United States. I mean, that doesn't mean that it hasn't inspired people elsewhere. But when it comes to the overlap with Guantanamo, I would say that it goes the other way, that Israel was actually an inspiration for the horrendous torture and abuse that was inflicted on prisoners in the war on terror by the United States, because they were drawing on the existing Israeli system of prisons for Palestinians, where torture and abuse are just rife, and not even with the pretense that that the people that they're rounding up are terrorists. I mean, we know categorically by now how inaccurate that was in terms of the U.S. and its dragnet of Muslims in the war on terror, that so many of these people, a vast majority of these people, had nothing to do with terrorism. But you know, what Israel does is terrorize Palestinians, regardless of whether they're regarded as having any military role or having been involved in anything that could be described as terrorism. It's a blanket abuse of Palestinians in general. I mean, I saw today the Israeli Supreme Court asked the government to provide information on how many of the people in Sde Tamim, the notorious torture prison, how many of the 1,000 men who are held there are regarded as Hamas militants? And the answer is 28. Can you believe that? 972 of the 1,000 men who are being subjected to torture, which is, you know, worse than most of what the Americans have done, are civilians. They're not anything to do with, they're not regarded as anything to do with October the 7th. They're not even regarded as militants. This is part of a blanket process on the part of Israel to treat every Palestinian as someone who can be tortured, abused, killed, It's the most disgraceful plunge into depravity that I think any of us have seen in our lifetimes from a country that is supposed to be, you know, nominally part of the so-called democratic West. It just beggars belief that that this has been happening, that it's still happening, and that they're continuing to get away with it.
Well, and it's not just men, though, too, right? We've got women, right, and even children in these prisons. And the latest today is CCTV footage from the prison being leaked or released. I'm not exactly sure how that it made it into the public realm of these gang rapes with rods and broom handles. And God knows, you know, I didn't have the stomach, honestly, to watch it, and maybe that's what's being counted on after all we've seen in these 10 months now, 10 months today of this latest turn in the ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people. It's difficult not to just turn away right at this point, I find.
It is, and yet we're all still stuck with the question of how does this end? I mean, it has to end at some point, surely. And when it does, the reckoning for the state of Israel is going to be colossal. I mean, more than anything that we could imagine. I think that we've seen in modern times, not because, you know, barbaric things aren't happening elsewhere in the world, but because this is so tied into our country's support of it, and so tied into to a country that is so drunk on its own genocidal frenzy that it's it broadcasts everything. It broadcasts it like it's a reality show. It is the most sickening thing I've ever experienced.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes now that I'm not just being a useful idiot in retweeting and so forth, that I'm just not helping some demented propaganda campaign by the entities that calls itself Israel right now. That it seems that they want these soldiers' TikToks and these CCTV footage and so forth to be disseminated to perhaps show everyone that we'll do these things and you can't do anything about it, or to terrify the people in Gaza and in the neighboring countries they plan to attack and are attacking next. I don't know.
They're definitely used to trying to terrify people, Chris. I think the damage they're causing to themselves is beyond anything that they've ever experienced before. And I kind of base this on a handful of brave, insightful, and eloquent Israelis that I follow who are writing about what it's actually like in Israel. That this is a spiritually dead country that has no enthusiasm for what it's doing, but has no interest in stopping it either, that has paralyzed itself through its long years of regarding itself as the only victim in world history, and arrogantly as these extremely special people who shouldn't be prohibited from doing anything that they think is required to defend themselves. And they've gone off the cliff edge into a darker place than any of us have seen. And I think, you know, we're seeing that. I mean, I can't imagine what the PTSD is going to be like. It's all right bigging yourself up while you're filming these horrific things that they've been getting up to, but war damages everyone who takes part in it. It absolutely does. It doesn't matter how much you think that you're right and that you're superior. Human beings aren't really fundamentally meant to do these kinds of things, and they end up traumatized and profoundly disturbed. And I think there's going to be an epidemic of that in Israel, and especially, you know, as Israel is going to become a pariah state. I believe that its economy is collapsing. I don't think any amount of artificial pumping of American money is really going to address the problem that Israel is increasingly becoming a country that people don't want anything to do with. Its tourism industry is screwed. Businesses are pulling out of investing in Israel, not even necessarily for moral reasons, but why, especially as the country makes itself a target the prime target in what appears to be its attempts to stir up a regional war. Why would you be investing your money in it? It's, you know, this is a, this appears to me to be a self-destroying mission that the country is on under this particularly deranged and horrible government.
Yeah, well, be careful what you wish for. And it seems that they wanted a regional war, and it just might be happening. And of course, the stock market crashing as well. People are getting, as you say, who would want to invest their money there? Their stock market has been going down, falling like a stone. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Andy Worthington. Andy's an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band. His book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the story of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge celebrating or celebration and subversion, and the Battle of the Beanfield. We're talking in and around his latest article, Lloyd's Austin Cynically Revokes 9/11 Plea Deals, which correctly concluded that the use of torture is incompatible with the pursuit of justice. This is an argument I remember from way back when, Andy, the with what was his name, Alberto Gonzalez, and when George Bush was in power, and the rendition program and the enhanced interrogation and all of that stuff. And back then, people like me and you were saying, oh, you know, if you're going in this route, this is going to lead to a terrible place, a codifying of torture. I mean, what are we, the Spanish Inquisition or something around here? But that seems to be what's happened. Now, in your article, Andy, it brings up the idea of, well, the legal, as I mentioned in the intro, the legal resistance to this in the United States is becoming vocal. This seems to me, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me to be going against the separation of powers, that a political actor is getting involved in a judicial decision, albeit one that was under his department of the military as Secretary of Defense, but still it seems to be a political meddling. Do you think that they there is a constitutional case, Andy, to be made here?
Well, I think technically, according to the Military Commissions Act, the convening authority responsible for making the decisions about the military commissions, plea deals, for example, is the Secretary of Defense, you know, but that position has always been delegated to somebody else. And what he's done here is pull rank. And he's not pulled rank on, you know, on some kind of junior officer. The woman who is the convening authority for the military commissions has a 32-year military history, and most recently was the chief judge in the U.S. Army Court of Appeals. And she has just been humiliated by her boss, who has, you know, pulled this case from her for nakedly political reasons. And so I think that it would be foolish not to expect that there will be a variety of legal challenges to this. And I'm not sure that he that Austin, you know, is standing on solid ground. The bigger problem, I suppose, Chris, is the reason that he's done it. And the reason that he's done it is because it is toxic to suggest that anyone involved in the 9/11 attacks shouldn't be executed by the United States. Now, the reason that the plea deals have been reached, and, you know, remember, this is 27 months that prosecutors have been negotiating. Prosecutors realize, despite their best intentions, that they simply were going to be unable to get these trials, if they ever start, to a successful conclusion. And that even if they got a guilty verdict, it would most likely be successfully challenged. This is the terrible impact of torture. So what they've come up with, is an evidently practical solution. And I must just correct something you said in the intro. I'm sure you didn't mean to. In no way is this going to lead to the release of these men. They are going to stay at Guantanamo for the rest of their lives. These are life sentences that are being offered to them in exchange for taking the death penalty off the table. But it is such a huge thing in U.S. political consciousness that, you know, that these men must be executed for the crimes that they committed, that it's unpalatable for anybody to try and tell the nuanced truth that it's impossible to do this because of what we did to them.
Well, I was referring, Andy, to the Guantanamo 16 that had been approved for release. Is that, am I getting that wrong?
Oh, no, sorry. Maybe I misheard, Chris. I thought you were...
Well, I did lump the two in. I lumped in the opening sentence that the Guantanamo men are still held, but having been received approval for release. And then as well, these other three high-value people, just to, so everybody's on the same page with us, that are, and I didn't mention they were facing the death penalty. That's an important omission, I think, because the death penalty, it's assumed, requires a higher degree of proof, at least in court, before such a heinous sentence can be enacted.
So, yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, this, so this is the bottom line, really. It's I think what it shows is, you know, that after nearly, what are we up to, Chris? Nearly 23 years after 9/11, mm-hmm. In various ways, the United States' obsession with vengeance, up to the point of, you know, killing the people who have wronged them, which, you know, most countries have quite conscientiously done away with over the decades. You know, my entire lifetime has been spent living in a country where we no longer have the death penalty. America doesn't want to let it go. You know, remember when they located Osama bin Laden? You would think Osama bin Laden, as the man who knew everything about everything, would be somebody that they wanted to capture alive, wouldn't you? But no. When they located Osama bin Laden, they sent in their special forces and they gave him a proper American Wild West execution.
And a proper funeral, they allegedly.
All the secrets gone with him, which of course presumably helps people who imagine that they did that because they had something to hide. But I think, you know, I think they did it because this is America. Shoot first and don't even ask questions. I mean, just vengeance, just pure vengeance. This is the, you know, what's interesting, Chris, I think, is that the military commissions, I mean, these men have been involved in pretrial hearings for 12 years. They're on the fourth judge. Some of the prosecutors have been working on this for 12 years, all 12 of these years. Some of the defense teams have as well. You know, and I know some of the defense people, and they seem to me to be indefatigable. And it may be that they get their energy because they know that they're fighting for the right thing, which is that you can't execute people that you've tortured. The United States needs to confront what it did openly and accept it. But the prosecutors, I get the feeling, are absolutely exhausted in trying endlessly to do what the government told them it's their job to do, when they have realized that that it's impossible. So this political move by Austin, just, you know, what does it do? It just kicks a can down the road again. The only people who will genuinely be happy about this, I suspect, are the CIA, because the CIA don't want any. They're happy for the men to just rot endlessly in Guantanamo without any procedure taking place that involves any kind of trial or any kind of plea deal, because their only concern is to keep secret everything that they did, all the people involved, under all circumstances. So, you know, if they just rot there forever and a legal process collapses and there's no plea deal, they'll be happy. But, you know, this is not a good look for the United States. And for Austin to have, I mean, how does the Defense Department and the government itself look when the story of the plea deals went round the world? For the first time in years, Guantanamo was a lead story on news broadcasts around the world, was featured in newspapers around the world. And 48 hours later, you know, this embarrassing climb down from the Secretary of Defense, it's shameful.
Well, and you write too about the hundreds of millions of dollars that have been spent in this. It creates its own military judiciary complex of a sort, but also it outlines, to at least to me anyway, as process as punishment, process the process as being the punishment. These men not knowing their future, what's going to happen to them in the case of those that have been approved for release but haven't been released, in the case of these who have the sword of Damocles as in the form of a military execution hanging over their heads. They don't know one day to the next if what's going to happen with them. As far as a process as punishment, in the final minutes we've got, Andy, you were involved with Julian Assange's case. Julian, of course, being released. We didn't talk about it the last time, didn't I? I failed to bring it up, and I meant to. Do you have any words in our final minutes about the process that punished Assange and his release?
Well, only that you know, he was required to admit that when he thought he was being a journalist, he was in fact, you know, breaking the Espionage Act. And he clearly said that very reluctantly. I remember reading about the long pause after the judge had asked him to concede that, you know, and he had to say yes. Otherwise, they, you know, I presume he would have been on a plane back to Belmarsh. So, you know, that hangs over things. But, you know, overall, I have to say that I think it was a victory in the sense that, you know, something finally brought this long legal purgatory to an end in a way that, you know, to return finally to Guantanamo. I think the men accused of involvement in the 9/11 trials and, you know, other high-value detainees, their biggest problem isn't whether there's a death penalty hanging over them. It's the fact that they've never received rehabilitation for the torture they received. And many of them have, you know, serious physical and mental health and or mental health conditions that the United States has categorically refused to address. For the whole of the 22 years that the prison is open. This is true for everybody. And this is despite prominent criticism from the United Nations about the necessity, the obligation on the United States to do this. So this still isn't being discussed. But, you know, the situation of the 16 men who have long been approved for release is a particularly shameful one for the United States. I mean, these men have been waiting for years now. Because it was an administrative review process that decided that they could be freed, much as Israel does with its administrative detention. You know, people are seized and released without any knowledge of when anything's going to happen. And these men at Guantanamo are stuck in a completely lawless place. They're not being freed because the U.S. government finds it inconvenient to prioritize their release and because the administrative decisions are not legally binding. They can't go to a judge and say, listen, these guys said they wanted to free me and I've been sitting here year after year after year and they've done nothing. It's perhaps a more mundane example of quite how lawless Guantanamo is and always has been. But it's no less disturbing if you imagine yourself in the situation of these men, you know, told what, 2, 3, 4 years ago that they were going to be freed from Guantanamo, in 3 cases 14 years ago, and not actually being freed. And that really needs to be resolved as swiftly as possible.
Yeah, it's a torture, and as I say, punishment of all its own. Talk about the long pause of the law. Andy, again, the article is Lloyd Austin cynically revokes 9/11 plea deals, which correctly concluded that the U.S. use of torture, or that the use, rather, of torture is incompatible with the pursuit of justice, something that would seem obvious on its face. Andy Worthington, thanks a lot. Go to Andy's website, andyworthington.co.uk, to read that article and much more, and about the vigils, the ongoing vigils for those that remain in America's torture prison. Thanks a lot, Andy, for coming on again, eh?
Thanks, as always, Chris. I always love talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course, and thanks to you, to Dave Lindorf. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time. Thanks, Andy.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago. Jakarta. Helsinki. Cape Town. Sao Paulo. Manchester. Bangalore.
The FCAT After School Podcast is back for its third season.
Starting January 10th, you'll hear interviews and profiles from Simon Fraser University's Faculty of Communication, Art and Technology alumni with lives lived and stories to tell.
Subscribe to the FCAT After School Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be sending a new episode down your feed every other Wednesday starting January 10th.
Or catch us on 90.1 FM CJSF every Tuesday at 4 p.m. starting January 16th.